Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of October 2nd, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a very appropriate dose of snark that warms even the darkest cockles of Brian's heart. Hey, guys, it's our General Conference edition.
That's right. We're going to give you a few of our general conference highlights and, I don't know, maybe talk about some of the online chatter. So we don't have a guest interview this week. We decided to focus entirely on conference. So next week, we'll resume our regular news commentary and guest interview format.
I mean, it's really not like this wasn't a newsworthy conference. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. But not having a guest interview doesn't mean we don't have a guest. We'd like to welcome back onto the show Stephen Smoot. Stephen, how is life on the mean streets of Toronto?
Toronto is treating me very well. Thank you for having me here. It's nice to get a little dose of Mormonism in between my classes and my master's program. So it's great to be with you. And it's good being back in Toronto. I like to say that Toronto is everything that Provo is not. Provo is monochromatic and monocultural and small. And Toronto is multicultural and multichromatic and big. And there's always interesting stuff going on. So I'm glad to be back here.
You are, Stephen, 4 hours away from me, right? So like we're technically in each other's backyard.
Oh, that's right. I hadn't even realized that. I guess there you go. I should stop by some weekend.
You guys should get together for lunch.
Perfect.
So Stephen's going to help us analyze a few of the talks that we're going to highlight. But before we start getting into the conference, let's just give Stephen the kind of introduction that he's always deserved from us. So Stephen, tell us a little bit about what you're doing up in Toronto. Studying ancient Near Eastern studies, is that right?
Yeah. So I'm in the second year of my master's program, and it's Near and Middle Eastern Civilizations, and my concentration is Egyptology. So I'm heading over to Egypt, hopefully this spring for the first time, to get in on some action there. And Egypt's great. Lots of good fun stuff happening there.
You have your safari hat picked out already?
Oh yeah, I have a whole rack of Indiana Jones hats and whips and stuff like that that I have ready to go at a moment's notice.
Wow.
It's required if you become an Egyptologist that you have to have a whole, you know, wardrobe of Indiana Jones stuff. So that's pretty nice.
I hope that you don't run into any pits of snakes. That's my one hope for you.
You know, snakes are okay. It's spiders I really don't care for. So I'd be okay with snakes, but yeah, I want to avoid all the spiders.
Giant rolling balls.
But yeah, those too, naturally, of course. But yeah, so things are going well for that. And I guess besides that, while I'm not in school, I'm working with Book of Mormon Central, which I'm sure you probably have talked about on your show, or maybe some of your listeners already know about.
Oh, we talk about it like every single week.
Every time, that's right.
But you know, you might want to remind us.
Well, okay. It never hurts, right? You know, shameless self-promotion, it's all fine. So yeah, Book of Mormon Central, stated very briefly, it's a research organization that's dedicated to highlighting and disseminating scholarship and research on the Book of Mormon that is made for free and available for everybody online at bookofmormoncentral.org. And so if you want to look up scholarship, artwork, podcasts, videos, all sorts of stuff that we have, Book of Mormon Central is your place to go to check it out.
And you've got a blog.
I do. I have also a personal blog. It's kind of a funny name. The blog is PlonyElmoneyMormon.com. Plony Elmoney.
Can you spell that?
Yeah, sure. It's PlonyElmoney. PlonyElmoneyMormon.com. And the name for it, it's from the Hebrew Bible. It's in the book of Ruth when Boaz sees the sky and he says, "Hey, Plony Elmoney," which is Hebrew for like, "Hey, so-and-so," or "Hey, Joe Schmo." So it's sort of the, you know, the thing is I'm just this Joe Schmo guy writing on a blog. So you can also check that out if that's kind of your jam.
So it wasn't just a Dr. Seuss thing?
No, no. Yeah, you might think so, right? Maybe it's like an ancient Dr. Seuss thing. I'm not quite sure, but I just know. Yeah.
Ancient Seussian,
exactly.
It makes sense, though, why your name on there is just like, what is this, like some random Mormon guy or something like that?
Yeah, Mr. So-and-so's Mormon blog. That's the premise of my blog. Yeah, exactly.
And that is one of the nerdiest things that I think I've ever heard. Guys, we got to get into it. We got a lot of stuff that we're going to get into. And so let's do it. Let's get into General Conference. A couple of things that we should say from the outset. It's amazing to think that we are at this point, but the videos of General Conference are now available on LDS.org. Like this literally just got over, what, a couple hours ago, and they're already out there. Additionally, if you guys are like me and you're podcast addicts, the podcast feed is also now available and the audio is already ready to go. I just checked my phone and I've got like, I don't know, like 28 different episodes in the General Conference queue that are already downloaded. So it's ready to go for those of you who want to listen.
So, Brand, if you had to guess, how many downloads do you think the Mormon Channel app gets over General Conference weekend? Thousands or tens of thousands?
Well, you know, it depends on who we talk to, because from what I found within the Mormon podcasting sphere, we take our numbers and we inflate them like three or four times what they're actually at. So I would go with tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Now, the second follow-up question, though, is how many deletes do you think the app gets right after conference ends?
So that is the interesting one, because it makes me wonder how many people actually just you know, keep it in their queue and never listen to it. But just to say that they've got it, if someone says, oh, what are you listening to? Oh, well, I've got the General Conference podcast right here. You know, it's kind of what I envision when I think of people who have the entire Hugh Nibley collection in their library with mint condition spines, which means they bought it just so they could have it and they've never bothered to read it. Maybe that's what people are like. I don't know.
So what you're saying is it's kind of like something you can quickly switch over to when your wife comes in and sees you listening to sports talk radio once again.
Exactly. It's like, oh, no, I wasn't listening to that. I was listening to General Conference. I mean, it's right here on my phone. It's no big deal. One of the reasons why we wanted to have Stephen onto the show was, Stephen, you and I were just, man, my fingers are absolute toast after this weekend. I actually tracked how many tweets I wrote. This is just tweets that I wrote, not retweets. 381 total tweets this weekend.
Wow. That's something.
I'm just utterly exhausted. And the thing is, like, so I've got I'm trying to watch it here. I've got my 3.5-year-old over here. I've got my 1.5-year-old over here. And I'm just sitting and you know, my wife and I both are trying to tag team with the two of them. I was just like, I'm done with this whole thing. All right. So a couple of lessons that I learned from Twitter on General Conference weekend. Number one, if the Mormon Tabernacle Choir ever retweets you, you're going to get a ton of likes, which was just amazing.
Did that happen to you?
It happened. Like, I said something along the lines of, I think it was like Sunday morning. Like, they just sounded really good to me. And I
really like their ties.
Yeah. Well, I mean, could you hook me up with the name of your tie designer? I mean, I'd really want to wear it. Because we all know that we all set our standards, our fashion standards, by what the Mormon Tabernacle Choir wore in their previous General Conference session.
Right. So let the men know what they can wear now.
Isn't that how we calibrate our spring and our fall catalog? That's why they have it in spring and fall.
Like, guys, this is the hot new color. Everyone needs to jump on this one.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's the other thing I learned. Deseret Book, as much as I give them a hard time, they can actually be really funny. By Common Consent tweeted something out. There was a talk about like the eclipse or something like that. And some, I will probably get into it, but someone was relating it to wearing gospel glasses or something like that. And By Common Consent tweeted something out along the lines of gospel glasses coming this winter from Deseret Book. And they tweeted back at him and said, hey, that's actually a pretty good idea. And I was like, wow, you guys have a personality and a sense of humor. Maybe I need to be nicer to you guys.
Yeah, it's just because they have a 19-year-old intern on managing their Twitter account.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's probably it. Oh, we have to be cool and engage with all these people. And hey, be self-deprecating.
How do you do, fellow youths?
Yeah, exactly. So, Stephen, tell me about this one. This is the other observation I had. The Uber Believer section of Twitter, it's really, really weird. And it's really uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah, and both the Uber Believer section and the Uber Non-Believer section. It's like the two poles, right, on the two sides here. But yeah, the Uber Believers, I don't know, between all like the Pinteresty quotes, I guess those are kind of, you know, innocuous, but some people can get really crazy if you make any kind of jokes about general authorities, you know, and so I was tweeting the whole time and I made some jokes and they're all very lighthearted, you know, maybe a little snarky, but nothing mean, nothing derogatory, nothing put down. And I had some of these Uber believers coming at me and they were just so mortified and offended that I would make any kind of joke about a general authority, right? And it just kind of, so sometimes they just kind of pile up like that. And so, yeah, I totally know what you're talking about. I don't know why they're on Twitter if they're not, you know, going to people to take a joke about general authorities or the church during conference, because that's what Mormon Twitter is doing most of the time during conference. And so these people can be a little crazy.
But don't you understand? We're supposed to be out there. We're just supposed to just retweet every 140 character sentence that ever comes out during General Conference, because that's how we're going to get the converts. That's what we have to do. So yeah, Stephen, look, I think you and I are in the same camp. Shout out to all the snarkers out there who are with me and with you, putting up with especially all my crap. So I've been doing this live tweeting and live blogging thing for probably about 7 years now or something like that. And I've actually found that I actually pay more attention when I do this, because you have to be listening to what people say. You're making jokes. And when you make a joke like that, it's like, oh, hey, apparently I retained something.
Absolutely.
I got to tell everybody who's listening, one of the things that we're going to talk about is a little game that I started playing, because I'll be honest, there are sometimes I get bored. So what I was doing was I was playing this looks like game. If I look at someone trying to figure out, okay, so what type of person would they be? I don't mean any disrespect by it. I really don't. But you'll hear about it and let's have some fun. And if I offend you, you can tweet at me or email us and just, you know, tell me how I'm an awful person. So, all right, let's get into it. Let's start with Women's Conference. Let's go through the speaker list really quickly. Sharon Eubank, who is the first counselor in the Relief Society presidency. Neil F. Marriott, who is the second counselor in the Young Women's presidency. Joy D. Jones, the primary general president. and Dieter F. Uchtdorf. He was the concluding speaker. Brian, Steven, did either of you guys watch the women's session and anything that stood out to you at all?
I didn't, Brant. I'm sorry. I failed.
Oh man, it's all on me because I did watch it, but this was a whole week ago. And in internet time, that's like, you know, 5 years ago for trying to remember things. No, I think the women's session was phenomenal and wonderful in a number of ways. Not the least of them is, and I sort of hate to say this, but just like the sheer amount of like confidence that was radiating from these sisters as they were talking. You know, people often joke about, or they sort of complain about the primary voice or the Relief Society voice or whatever, right? Like this tend to be very sort of timid and sort of, you know, but I did not hear that at all during the women's session, right? I heard very robust, very confident, very, I guess you could say assertive sisters here speaking. And I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was marvelous. They're, you know, very direct, very honest, you know, none of this sort of timid kind of soft whispery kind of speech. So I thought that was great.
Right. And I think that was something. So I was on Twitter kind of following what people were saying. And it was mostly a lot of the women who were on Twitter at this point that were tweeting. And the thing that they were saying and the thing that so many other people were saying was exactly that. I think there was this stereotype that a lot of these women were going to speak, like you were saying, you know, the whole joke about the primary voice thing. But when your first speaker is Sharon Eubank and her talk and the way that she spoke, it did not sound like what we usually hear from women. And I think it's because it was a direct, honest, and blunt style of speaking. As a matter of fact, it sounded a lot like business style speaking, something that I'm used to seeing at work, especially from once you get higher up in the food chain, some of the executives, the way that they speak. It was interesting that we were watching. I was watching it with my wife, and even she kind of looked up and said, wow, something is really different here, because it was something new that she hadn't seen before. So a couple of interesting things about Sharon Eubank. After she graduated, first off, she got her bachelor's in English from BYU. She taught English as a second language in Japan. She worked as a legislative aide in the U.S. Senate and owned a retail education store in Provo. Since 1998, she's been employed by the Church Welfare Department. She, in 2008, was also asked to oversee the humanitarian work in the Middle East. And in 2011, she was named the director of LDS Charities Worldwide. And I wonder if a big part of that experience that she had, all those things, contributes to a very different speaking style, because you kind of are running and heading an organization. And I think it forces you to speak differently.
Yeah, I think there's probably truth to that. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
So the other thing that stood out to me was the diversity in the multiculturalism that was seen to be showcased from the stories that they talked about from people in a lot of different parts of the world. I think sometimes within the church, when we like to say these stories, we kind of go to our, I really don't mean to be insensitive or disrespectful, but we kind of go to our pet areas. We like to go to like Brazil or Mexico or places like that. Sometimes we go to Africa. But what I'd like to see was a lot of different people from a lot of different areas. And some of the pictures that they showed and some of the stories that they told seemed to be talking about people from India and people from all over the world. And I wonder if part of that is because of the Young Women and Relief Society boards, especially the Young Women's Board, which consists of 9 different women. So they've got one from Peru, one from South Africa, one from Brazil, one from Japan, one from Brooklyn, New York. So that's 5 people from outside of Utah and 4 from inside Utah. And I think that plays a factor in how you approach all these different cultures, because it's not always a U.S. or a Utah-centric perspective. And what I'm trying to say is I wish that we would get some of that more from the general church conferences or whatever you'd like to call them. But it did stand out in that Young Women's Conference. So I'm not sure if either of you, if that has ever stood out to you, that the women's groups seem to be doing a much better job showcasing different cultures. So one of the other things that stood out to me, and this was because of the kerfuffle that happened probably about 2, maybe even 3 years ago, President Uchtdorf was a concluding speaker, and he said of the women's session, it was great to begin General Conference with a worldwide sister session, and it was significant and wonderful. And I just remember about 3 or 4 years ago, there was that whole argument on, was women's session part of General Conference? Was it not? Someone said that it was, and then Mormon Newsroom said it wasn't. I think here we can finally sit there and say, yes, it's part of General Conference. And I know for quite a few women online, that did mean a lot, that he said it was significant and wonderful to be kicking off with the women's session.
Well, you know, if you go to LDS.org and you look up General Conference, like you look up the talk summaries or whatever, like what I'm looking at right now, you look at October 2017, and it just lists it right there alongside Saturday morning session, Saturday afternoon session, general priesthood session, right? I think it's pretty clear at this point that it's become solidified, the general women's session, as a part of General Conference. And I think, again, that's another positive step in the right direction, a step forward where we can have this more sort of egalitarian experience between the sisters and brethren in the church when we're talking about General Conference. And so it may have been sort of shocking back when it first happened, you know, like you said, 3-4 years ago or whatever. But, you know, clearly this seems to be the direction that the church is going, and I think that's great.
And you know, the crazy thing, the crazy thing is going to be, we're going to look back on it. I think you're going to have some people that are going to be becoming adults and maybe getting more into just the overall history of Mormonism. They're probably going to look at that and say, that was the thing. Like, that was really an argument. And well, yeah, of course it is. But it's just, it's going to be interesting that we're like living through this. It doesn't mean anything to us, except it's going to be a continual callback. I do wonder if it would make a difference if, say, that women's session were on a Friday night instead of being the week before, because it does kind of seem detached. And I wonder if that contributes to people's thinkings. If all of a sudden you've got Friday nights, the women's session, and then Saturday, 3 sessions, and then Sunday, 2 sessions, it might help people to realize, oh yeah, it's all part of the same thing. Okay, so let's get into everything today. There was a couple of people who weren't there. Brian, the two people that weren't there were...
Well, President Monson, who was at home watching it, despite rumors otherwise, which we'll get into, and Elder Robert D. Hales, who we'll talk about a little bit more as well.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that didn't Mormon Newsroom or the church put out a statement beforehand saying they weren't going to be there? Is my memory correct in that?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's interesting. I don't know. You guys with your collective knowledge might know a little bit more than me. I don't remember that happening before. It was always just, oh, well, I guess Elder Packer's not going to be there today. He's not feeling very well. But this seemed very proactive, and I think it actually helped to dispel a lot of the rumors, despite the fact that there was something that was floating around. But can you guys remember that ever happening before?
You mean where they release an official sort of notification saying it's going to happen?
Yeah, proactively and preemptively release.
No, I don't think I can think of any.
No, I haven't seen any in my lifetime, but I would think that with the profile of President Monson, that was important that they issued out a statement for him. And then I would almost think, and I'm not saying this is their decision making, but I would almost think that if they were to issue a statement about Monson and then not issue a statement about Hales, then people would be like, well, what's up with that? Mm. You know? So I think it kind of made you have to acknowledge anybody who wasn't going to be there. And, you know, to be honest, I wouldn't doubt it if this becomes standard practice from this point forward.
So speaking of official statements coming out, Stephen, it was kind of a weird statement that came out from the Mormon Newsroom where Eric Hawkins had to make a public statement to say Thomas S. Monson isn't dead.
Or at least the rumors of his death were greatly exaggerated.
Precisely. Right. Well, the reason why the church had to release a statement is because a certain podcaster who's rather infamous on the internet, he was going around and he had said, quote, I have heard from a very credible tip or a very credible source that President Monson has died. Can anybody confirm this? And he posted it to Facebook and he posted it to Reddit and to Twitter all over the place. And that lit up for everybody, of course. And they started freaking out. And I heard, and it wasn't just this person. I heard other people who started asking, oh, I've heard it too. What's going on here? So this sort of sparked these rumors, I think this podcaster had sparked these rumors that President Monson had died. And so the church had to come out and they had to release an official statement. So I think we can thank this fine gentleman for starting all of this rigmarole this weekend about President Monson passing away, which of course is not true.
Oh, to even one up it too. I've even heard some people saying that they're keeping Monson on ice and that they were going to hold off until after General Conference to make the announcement, which, I mean, always seemed really goofy to me because when would be the most opportune time to make the announcement and to make the switch to the new first presidency, right? I mean, they're all there together. Obviously, that's the time to do it. But still, I mean, people go nuts over this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the nature of the internet, right? And, you know, if one person starts this and before you know it, it just spreads like wildfire and it's difficult to stamp out. And so it's understandable that the church had to step in and, you know, say something. I will say though, however, and you know, take this with a grain of salt, but I have heard a very credible tip that this same podcaster is going to be called as the next apostle. So if anybody out there can confirm this, that would be great, because I have a very reliable source saying that this is going to happen.
Yeah, this is really important because it's a very credible tip. We just got to get confirmation though, but it's a very credible tip, guys.
Yeah, as any standard news organization will tell you, any reliable reporter will tell you, the first thing you do is go public with these tips you're getting to confirm if they're real before you print them, before you go public with them. That's
standard journalistic practice, isn't it?
Standard. That's journalism 101, right? Yeah, exactly.
Listen, we all know We all know if Woodward and Bernstein were still doing reporting today, the first place that they would go would be to Reddit to confirm a credible tip. Hello, it's just standard practices, guys. I mean, how do you people not get this? And let me just say this one thing. I'm going to co-opt a phrase from The Incredibles. When everybody has a credible tip or an inside source, then nobody does. I am so incredibly sick and tired of hearing every single person who's trying to get any little ounce of internet fame try and co-opt whatever relationship they might have with somebody or somebody else just because they want to show how connected they are. Holy crap, guys. Give me a break. Everybody's got an insider source. Everyone's got a credible tip. You don't need to flaunt it out there and show it off for everyone to see. But nope, this is the life that we lead when we're on the Mormon internet. So speaking of both President Monson not being there and Elder Robert T. Hales not being there, we found out this afternoon, so we're recording this on Sunday night for release on Monday morning, but we found out that this afternoon that just after the Sunday morning session of General Conference, Elder Robert D. Hales passed away. He was 85 years old. Peggy Fletcher Stack said he died peacefully today at 12:15 p.m. in the hospital, surrounded by his wife and family, according to church spokesperson Eric Hawkins. Nelson, President Russell M. Nelson, was also at Hales' side. Robert D. Hales suffered two heart attacks before becoming an apostle, and he was an apostle for 23 years, from 1994 to 2017. So Brian, let me ask you this. I wasn't able to listen to the very end. I know that President Irene gave some very touching words. Did any of the other apostles mention or speakers at all for this afternoon? Did they mention the passing of Elder Hales at all?
Yeah, Elder Anderson, who closed the conference, spoke of Elder Hales' passing, both at the very beginning of his talk as well as at the end. He actually was able to quote a few lines from the talk that Elder Hales was preparing for this conference and but was not able to give. It was a very touching moment.
I just think it's interesting that he had already prepared a talk. Obviously, I don't think that neither he nor the people who were in charge of putting together the agenda for General Conference thought that he would be ill enough to do it. But it's always very interesting to see that. And I heard the same thing. I heard it was very touching. And we'll probably get into that as we get to Elder Anderson's comments at the end of General Conference. But Stephen, did you have any thoughts about the passing of Elder Hales?
You know, I think it's just kind of fitting that, well, I don't know if fitting is the right word, but I thought it was maybe significant, or you could find significance in the fact that he passed away in between sessions of conference, a time when the saints are very attentive towards the words of general authorities, when obviously the general authorities are on the minds of the saints and they're looking to them for wisdom and guidance. To hear of this news of his passing literally in between sessions, right? I guess, again, in a way of sort of fitting, you might say, for Elder Hales, who had dedicated his life to working in the ministry and working for the church, and they had that opportunity to hear his last words, you might say. So even though, you know, of course, we're all very sad and we offer all of our condolences to the Hales family, we can get a little bit of consolation, I guess, out of that, a very fitting sort of send-off tribute to him, if you might say.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's get into the Saturday session of General Conference. Let's start with the morning session. Speakers included Dieter F. Uchtdorf, Bonnie L. Oscarson, Dallin H. Oakes, John Pingree Jr., who, by the way, my wife said apparently had the voice of an audiobook narrator and had the jawline of a perfect bishop, so whatever that means, D. Todd Christofferson, and Jeffrey R. Holland. But guys, the talk that anyone's going to be talking about from the morning session is probably going to be Elder Dallin H. Oakes' talk. He blew up the internet. It was a talk that was specifically geared towards a lot of the same-sex marriage headwinds that are happening. He was not very happy about a couple of people who had been talking about the proclamation on the family. Here's a couple of quotes from him. Just 18 years after the family proclamation, the United States Supreme Court authorized same-sex marriage, overturning thousands of years of marriage being limited to a man and a woman. President Benson taught that every generation has its test. One of the great tests of our generation is this matter of family. If we cling to our values and cling to our inheritance, we will be blessed in a magnificent way. We will be viewed as a people who have found the key to unique happiness. Stephen, I don't think it's an understatement to say that when this talk was going on, wow, it was, the internet was taking this pretty toughly. And I don't mean to say that we need to always judge everything based on the reaction of the internet, but this was, I don't know, this one was different to me.
Well, it's very clear that for a lot of people, this is a very personal and very real matter on both sides of the debate, right? I often sometimes half seriously and half jokingly say that the church's position on same-sex marriage is what happens when a theological immovable object is met with a cultural unstoppable force. You know, you have seriously these locked horns over this matter, and it's very polarizing for a lot of people because it's very personal for a lot of people. And so I can understand, and I saw, you know, in live, I saw it live happening on Twitter where people were getting progressively more animated both for and against Elder Oaks' comments while he was making them. I think maybe the sort of the takeaway point from Elder Oaks, and this is what's getting people really upset, either upset or they're getting them very, you know, animated to defend Elder Oaks, is he made it very clear, I believe, that from the perspective of the leadership of the church, the Family Proclamation and the doctrines and the principles of the Family Proclamation are not just some nice legal cultural thing that they sort of believe in. For them, this is inspired doctrine, right? This is, Elder Oak said, this is God's eternal doctrine. This is his eternal law for us. And so they are doubling down on this, not surprising considering, you know, the November 5th policy from 2 years ago that was instigated and so forth. So the brethren are doubling down on this. They're sticking to their theological guns. You know, they're not going to have any of this talk that we hear in some corners of, well, Family Proclamation is this nice thing, but it's just some old legal document they came up with. It's not inspired. It's not revelatory at all. It seems clear to me that Elder Oaks and the Brethren are fighting against this and doubling down on it. And so that's why it's getting people animated.
Yeah. And I've already seen from corners of the internet that Elder Oaks is just being a poor sport because apparently he had attempted to get the proclamation canonized this year and it was rejected. And so now he's just kind of lashing out. I don't think there's any credence to that. In my opinion, it sounds like utter nonsense. But in regards to the legal side of it, I mean, this thing does have a legal history behind it. Now, you know, I want to be careful because obviously it's being seen as an inspired document. At this point, it's being taught as an inspired document. And if you look at the history of how Revelation works, it seems like Revelation does usually follow some sort of push or an impetus to seek that revelation, right? There's usually some sort of an item or something that it's responding to, and it becomes revelatory. So, I mean, we do know, historically speaking, that this revelation came about during the battle in Hawaii over same-sex marriage. And so, you know, first of all, for any people who are listening, if you hear members of the church saying, this was put out a quarter of a century ago, way before same-sex marriage became a legal issue. Look how prophetic it was. Number one, cut out that nonsense because same-sex marriage was an issue a quarter of a century ago as well. This did formulate about that same time. There was an interesting article that was posted on Rational Faiths by Laura Compton. She sort of traced the history of the Proclamation on Family. And I'm just going to read one little excerpt from it, just the last paragraph. She said, the Proclamation on the Family began its national political role when it was read into the official records of the U.S. House of Representatives on November 17th, 1995, 4 days after President Hinckley met with U.S. President Bill Clinton. It has been used in dozens of court cases, legislative sessions, hearings, and conventions in the United States and around the world, wherever issues of same-sex marriage, gender roles, abortion, family values, or defense of marriage acts have been brought up. And then she provides a timeline, and I'm not going to go through the timeline, but I will note, I think it's interesting anyway, that this was one of the very first acts that President Gordon B. Hinckley did after he became church president. He became church president in March of 1995, and the Family Proclamation was read in September of 1995. So this was very much in the beginning of his presidency.
And that's like a super sped up timeline when you take into consideration how conservatively the church moves, or how slowly the church moves on so many of these issues. A couple of things that just pop off right at the top of my head. So I try and use a few people in my life as barometers, because as you both know, the deeper you get into some of this stuff, and when I say deeper, I mean like when you're around some of these Mormon groups and you're as engaged in online Mormonism as we are, sometimes it's tough to see the forest of the trees. And so I use other people as my own personal barometers to say, okay, you're a normal Mormon. Is this on your radar or is it just me? And this talk specifically for at least three people that I talked to, they were like, I'm done. I'm done with this. I'm done hearing about this. Gay marriage is a thing. Like, at what point are we going to keep banging this drum? At what point? Specifically, one person told me, at what point is it not going to feel like the church has sour grapes because they lost? And I think that's a valid point to bring up. The second thing is, I'll just be blunt. It felt like someone who was not happy that there was this chatter going around in a few circles that it's policy. It's the same reaction that I kind of saw from when other people were talking about the November 5th policy change. They said it was a policy. It wasn't revelation. And then President Nelson goes to BYU and gives that devotional where he says, no, this was a revelation. This wasn't just policy. And it feels like they get a little upset that people are having this conversation. I just kind of sit there and go, where are we going with this, some of this stuff? But I think this is the problem. And Brian, you hit on it. There's two sets of narratives that are going on. there's the narrative that Oaks displays, which is that they felt compelled to discuss families, and that's where this came from. And then there's the narrative of the 1993 Hawaii Supreme Court ruling, and that's in Laura's article. And the truth is probably in the middle. Both were most likely in play regarding this issue, but it's still a really divisive issue. But if we have to take something out of this, I will say this. The cherry on top of this sundae, I think, and you two can correct me if I'm wrong, this was the only talk on gay marriage or homosexuality in all of General Conference's time around, wasn't it?
Yeah, at least the only one that I could remember that like directly addressed it, right? You of course have sort of the natural language of, oh, we have to, you know, stick to our values and our standards and so forth. But this was the only one, at least that I recall, that directly addressed same-sex marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. And by comparison, we had what, like five talks that referenced the recent hurricanes and national, you know, natural disasters. You know, but still, this is going to be the one that everyone talks about because, you know, nobody pays more attention to every word of General Conference and yet locks onto such little, like angry ex-Mormons who are just rooting around for any possible dirt clump that they can lob against the church. Brant, frankly, sometimes it feels like watching gorillas at the zoo tossing their own poo.
So I think that's a good way to kind of end the Oaks discussion, is that mental image of gorillas tossing their own poop. So guys, so let's talk about this Jeffrey R. Holland fellow. I'm not sure about you, but I think he's got a bit of a potential to be a great speaker. What do you think?
I mean, I'd like to see where he goes, you know, some of his material, but definitely has the potential there for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So let's go through a couple of quick quotes from Holland. Aside from Christ, there have been no flawless performances. Let us strive for constant improvement rather than obsessing over toxic perfectionism. A priest said, look at my life now and look at my prior life. Don't attack the path I follow. If I follow the path, but follow it drunkenly, is it nonetheless the path? And finally, don't gloat. Give your heart to anyone attempting to walk back to God. And I really think this is Holland doing what Holland does best. And Stephen, look, I'm sorry, listeners. I know that we're talking a lot about Twitter, but I'm being completely honest. You have not experienced General Conference until you've experienced it on Twitter. Stephen, I'm going to be perfectly blunt. I get so uncomfortable when I see Mormon Twitter start blowing up because they find out that Jeffrey R. Holland is going to be the next speaker. I hope I'm not the only one that feels that way.
You know, I can understand that. I know I've read some articles back in the day that say they're kind of uncomfortable with, you know, sort of this, if we dare say, sort of hero worship cult, you know, hero cult worship of Elder Holland during General Conference. And so I can understand that sentimentality, or that sentiment. I just kind of go along with it because it's kind of funny to sort of joke about it, right? The fact that some people just like lose their minds when they hear Elder Holland is going to speak. So I'm mostly just in it for the lulz on Twitter when I sort of, you know, retweet these memes and so forth. Elder Holland's great. We all love Elder Holland, but it's good not to lose focus the fact that there's all these other brethren and sisters who are also giving wonderful talks as well.
Right. And guys, don't be so weird. Like, gosh, don't make me cringe every time I see this stuff. Look, I get the fact that you like listening to him talk, but like, oh, just keep it to yourself. I don't know. All right. So let's move on to Saturday afternoon and the priesthood session. Saturday afternoon, first thing that stands out to me, holy crap, that youth choir. Look, I'm a young men's president, okay? I don't mean to drop my calling here on the table in front of you guys to just have it examined. But what I'm trying to say is I work with youth all the time. Try as they might, those poor teenage boys just did not have the vocal range. They couldn't hit those low notes if their life depended on it. And they tried so hard. And I think the best part about it was the looks that these boys had on their faces. They were like quintessential looks that you would get from you. So you've got like the forced smiles. You've got the varying degrees of detachedness. You've got some boys that are trying to act like they're not really into it because they don't want to seem like they're too into it. And then you've got others that are like way into it because they saw that they were going to be on TV.
Well, and then the other ones who are trying to like discreetly Instagram themselves, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. If I hold it up here underneath the seat, no one's going to see the camera, so it'll be okay. So anyways, so the youth choir, like I said, they were adorable. The other thing they do on Saturday afternoon is the sustaining of church officers. I'm not sure about you guys. I didn't hear any opposition votes. Someone on Twitter said they might have turned down the house mics, but either way, I figured there would be more traction online. We'd be seeing people on Facebook or Reddit or Twitter that were posting that they were part of that group if they did oppose. But maybe this is the end of the vocal oppositions. President Eyring did make this remark that anyone with opposition votes should talk to their state president. So maybe that's something that we didn't see. I didn't hear anything. I'm not sure if either of you did. And I actually cranked up the volume on our TV to make sure that we could hear if they were going to say anything.
No, I think it's just because Mike and Nicolaisen didn't show up this year.
You know what? I love Mormon Insider Baseball.
Yeah, that's name dropping right there, if nothing else is.
He's made it to the big time. Okay, so speakers, Gary E. Stevenson. So here's what we get into the looks like game. Gary E. Stevenson looked like a 13-year-old giving a talk in church wearing his dad's sport coat. And this is a theme that I saw over and over again. Somebody needs to get with the general authorities and take them to a tailor, or maybe take them to someone that's not Mr. Mac, who's going to give you guys, like, I don't know, potato sacks for suits, and actually get the, you know, make sure that the shoulder pads line up on the shoulder correctly and get it, you know, anyways.
I wonder if they go to the same place where Trump gets his suits.
I think we just lost our sponsorship opportunities with Mr. Mac.
I'll make it up to him. So the big news that was coming out of this was Quentin L. Cook's talk. And he actually gave a quote where he talked a lot about racism, sexism, nationalism, things like that. So, Stephen, what were your thoughts on Elder Cook? And did you write down what he said?
Yeah. So for me, this is the money quote. And this was in the middle of his talk when he said, "Anyone who claims superiority under the Father's plan because of characteristics like race, sex, nationality, language, or economic circumstances is morally wrong."
Woo!
That's right there. You know what I mean? That it's as clear as you're going to get. Well, you know, Elder Ballard also, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but Elder Ballard had some similar comments. But the big emphasis here for Elder Cook and for others was, this is a worldwide church. It is a multicultural church. It is a multilingual church. And so, you know, hardcore nationalism, sort of ethno-nationalism, these sorts of things, this is not cool. Xenophobia is not cool. Any of this sort of stuff has no place in the church today. And, you know, I think the big gorilla in the room here that everybody is aware of is what happened earlier this year with Charlottesville and all this other racial and strife and tension that's been going on in the country. There was, of course, I think it was just last month when the church, or 2 months ago, in the church, the newsroom issued its official condemnation of white nationalism and ethno-nationalism, that sort of thing. So this can't be a coincidence at all, I don't think. I think it's very clear that Elder Cook is responding to these political and cultural circumstances. And he made it very clear where the church stands on that. And boy, was it a powerhouse moment, right? You could see it on Twitter. You could see it. Everybody, they knew it was clear as crystal what was going on here.
So... Can I be the Eeyore? I'm so sorry. Okay, so no, I'm with you. Like, it was one of those things where it was like, I did a fist pump in the air. Like, how lame is that? I'm sitting here at my kitchen table. I'm trying to live tweet this. I did a physical fist pump in the air when he did that. The problem that I have is this. That is a great sentence, and a sentence that I want people to say over and over and over again, because frankly, there's a couple of people out there who are too stupid to get it through their thick skulls that white nationalism has no place in the LDS church, right? So here's my Eeyore. It's a sentence. I wanted more.
Yeah.
And I'll say it this way. I wanted more because when the church came out with that statement, I actually talked to someone and was trying to talk about everything that's going on, including showing them, yeah, like, this is what the church actually said. Like, I pulled it up on my iPad. This is it. Boom. There's Mormon Newsroom. Well, I just think we need to be careful and blah, blah. And I'm sitting here going, what are you talking about? We need to be careful. Like, do you not get what's going on here? And I think that's the thing that stood out. So on the one hand, it's like, yes, I don't know how much more clearer you can make it. But at the same time, there are some people out there, and maybe this is the thing. There are some people out there who are just never going to get it. So therefore, there's not much you could do.
Or if I can suggest, either they won't get it or they're purposely not going to get it. They're going to choose not to get it. I've had conversations with some individuals where I could sort of see unfold in real time the cognitive dissonance when I confronted them with the statement from the Mormon Newsroom. And the most charitable way, I think, to say it is that they would not allow themselves to get it or to accept it, right? It ran so contrary to their political views that they just could not accept it. And so either just out of people wanting to be, you know, timid and, well, I don't know, like you said, or it could be there are some individuals who they just choose not to. I'm just not going to believe this.
That's a fair point. And I mean, I don't know what you could do about people like that. I, on the other hand, though, like, it is out there and it was in clear terms, and it wasn't just him. We'll talk about what Ballard said in just a minute. President Nelson also spoke. Stephen, I noticed that he was emphasizing the Book of Mormon. I'm sure that was just a warm, you know, flowing. I'm running out of an analogy here, but I'm sure you were just.
it was like being wrapped in a big warm blanket.
There you go.
Hearing President Nelson testify the Book of Mormon, emphasizing the importance of the Book of Mormon.
The gospel burrito.
Yeah, a big gospel burrito. Exactly. There you go. Perfect. Yeah, he gave this wonderful sort of anecdote where he was speaking with this tribal leader in Africa, and he talked about the Book of Mormon with him, and the tribal leader said, you know, oh, well, great. I think I may convert with my whole village right now. And And President Nelson had to, you know, say, oh, hold on a second, it doesn't quite work that way. And he sort of framed it by this way of emphasizing the significance of gaining an individual testimony of the Book of Mormon for yourself, the importance of the Book of Mormon, how important it is to have a testimony of it, especially as you face trials and challenges in your life. But it's interesting, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, I'm sure, but he sort of set the stage, in my opinion, for what Elder Callister said the next day. So Elder Nelson sort of, you know, prepped us with this paradigm of the significance of the Book of Mormon, but Elder Nelson's emphasis was entirely doctrinal, right? He talks about how it has the gospel of Christ, how it testifies of Christ, how it gives us, you know, he says it confirms certain doctrines, it disconfirms other doctrines, it helps us understand the atonement, et cetera, et cetera. And he really didn't get into, look, you know, the historicity is important. That was more Elder Callister. But nonetheless, I just thought it was wonderful. I thought it was marvelous. And between Elder Nelson and Elder Callister, or President Nelson and Elder Callister, right, I think, personally, I think it's very clear that despite all the CES letters in the world, that the church is not backing down from either the doctrinal or the historical authenticity of the Book of Mormon, right? The Book of Mormon is here to stay, and, you know, people are just going to have to, you know, make sense of this if it sort of conflicts with their paradigm in some way. But I loved the talk. I thought it was phenomenal.
There's no question that the Book of Mormon was a strong focus at this conference.
Right. And I think that was, I think you take that and what Stephen said, like, it's, well, you said, it's not going away. Because I was getting a little bored. I was trying to entertain myself. President Nelson looks like he always has a jar of hard toffee candy next to his reclining chair and then offers it to you 5 times per hour. Like, hey, you want some toffee?
If it was salt water, then I would, you know, then that'd be a more righteous offering.
I'm thinking like Werther's, you know, like traditional, or even like the hard cinnamon candies or something like that.
Or what about those little candies that are wrapped? They look like watermelon, right? Like in the watermelon wrappers and
like a strawberry, little strawberry. Right?
Yeah,
that's the official old person candy. I don't even think that you can buy it unless you go to, like, I think you have to have an ARP member card. By that.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so let's get into priesthood. Priesthood had Dale G. Renlund, Dale F. Evans, Richard J. Maines, Dieter F. Uchtdorf, Henry B. Eyring, and President Monson was absent. My looks like game. President Eyring is the type of guy who would have a sincere and legitimate belly laugh at a joke on a Laffy Taffy wrapper. Like, I imagine him like keeled over, like just like tears in his eyes.
I imagine he's probably submitted a few. That's my guess.
Oh, he is the type of guy who would like read one, say, oh, that is good, and put it in a drawer in his house and save them because he wants to use it for later.
That's, and tell it to his grandkids when they come over.
Right. So let's see. Dale Renlund kicked us off, and we'll just go through some quick ones. You guys tell me if you have any thoughts on any of them. He was talking about rockets and payloads. So I stay home, but now that I'm working with the young men's group, I went to the church, A, because of the young men, and B, because it's free pizza and I wanted some pizza. So he was talking about rockets and payloads, and I'm sitting in a group of this young men. And as soon as he mentioned payload, all the teenagers in my ward, they perked up. And I think they thought he was going to make an Overwatch payload race reference, the video game. But that didn't happen. I almost want to, like, you know, kind of give him a boop upside the head and say, guys, no, just get Overwatch out of your brains.
Wait a second. You made fun of my blog for being nerdy, and you just made an Overwatch reference here.
I did.
I play Overwatch, by the way. So I know what you're talking about here. So don't pretend like you're not a nerd.
Listen, no, it's because I have to be with the young men. And so that's my excuse.
Okay, sure. Uh-huh. I bet you're a Hanzo main, right? Everybody will know what that means who plays the game. Yeah.
We lost Mr. Max, so now I'm trying to court Overwatch to come in and sponsor the show. So the best Twitter quote that I saw during Elder Renlund's talk, if this talk turns into a morality talk, I'm going to laugh very hard. And my first thought was, well, heck, if it becomes a morality talk, do we replace little factories with little payloads now?
Little rockets. Oh, no.
Oh, that's no. That's bad. That's bad.
Yeah. Little rockets. Yeah. Let's go to Evans. Stephen, anything that stands out about Elder Evans' talk?
Hey, Elder Evans, I thought was interesting, this emphasis that he had on answering questions and finding answers to questions through patience and faith and study. It was the same as Elder Ardern on Sunday afternoon. Both of them very heavily emphasized how to sort of properly think and feel and work through when you have questions or doubts or things of that nature. They both quoted Doctrine and Covenants section 88 that talks about seeking wisdom out of the best books and gaining a testimony by study and also by faith. I know Elder Ardern later, he plugged one of the Gospel Topics essays in the middle of his talk, which was quite remarkable. We're hearing it from over the pulpit. And so I think the takeaway for me, for Elder Evans, was that the brethren are very really sincerely concerned about making sure that members of the church know about how to engage critically with historical or doctrinal questions, that they're familiar with the resources that are out there, that they can be taught how to think and feel through these problems, and to not, you know, sort of freak out when they encounter questions or they don't have all the answers to everything. And so it was very timely, it was very relevant, and it's always a welcomed reminder, I felt.
If we can get as many plugs as possible for the Gospel Topics essays out there, I think it's great. We need to make more members aware of it. One of the criticisms that we constantly get lobbed against us is that we're all, you know, yeah, sure, they wrote the Gospel Topics essays, but, you know, they've buried them on the website. And you have to, you know, seriously dig deep to find those things. They don't really want you to find them. They know that once you start digging through those, you're going to be thrown into a faith crisis and you're going to quit the church.
Yeah, right. You know, I have a joke where, you know, I say for some people, it will never be good enough unless or until the church clamps your eyes open like on a Clockwork Orange and President Uchtdorf administers the eyedroppers while they force you to read them, right? While they're blasting Wagner and Beethoven in your ears, right? it just seems like for some people, no matter how much, you know, the church does to raise awareness and to make these resources accessible, for some individuals, it just will never be enough. And so you just can't really do much with those kind of people.
So moving on, Elder Maines was the next speaker. His was your pretty, I need to be nice. It was a talk on truth and integrity. It was something that you would expect to hear from a priesthood session. The one thing that stood out to me was he told this crazy story about a client providing quote information about competitors. And I'm someone who works in the manufacturing industry. That's not completely insane, but what was insane was he did that with this guy's son in the room. So Elder Maines was in the room as a young child. And the CEO of this other company said, if you bid a dollar below this guy, we'll give you the quote, we'll give you the contract. And guess what? We'll split the difference of what you originally said because your company's already thinking you're going to be paying X amount. This sounds completely insane. And I will tell you this, I haven't been directly involved with these negotiations, but I've been on the periphery. Stuff like this does happen. It's not as extreme as this, but it does happen and it's not completely foreign. So it was one of those things where it was like, oh, people are probably going, wow, this is an extreme example. And I'm sitting here going, yep, this happens. And then rounding out everything else that we had going on. So you had President Uchtdorf speak and President Eyring speak. It was your normal feel good types of talks from them for a general conference priesthood session. I ended up leaving during the intermission. And so as I was driving home, I was streaming it on my car. And that's where I just started having all these, you know, I don't know what it is. President Eyring, I just get these warm fuzzies about him because I do genuinely feel he is just this genuinely happy, sincere guy. And I think that just emanates with the way that he talks. All right. So moving on to Sunday morning. Sunday morning is the big time. Stephen, I got to ask, do you have any Sunday morning general conference traditions, any food that you eat, any things that you do aside from tweeting general conference?
You know, not really much these days. I'm just on my own out here in Toronto. So I just kind of wake up and have a bowl of cereal and then watch conference. So nothing really exciting, I'm afraid to say, but maybe I can start, depending on how much longer I'm up here, if I do my PhD up here, maybe I can start Sunday morning with like a plate of poutine or some Tim Hortons or something like that, you know, and drink some maple syrup. I guess I could start a new tradition, right?
Like if you're in Canada and the fact that that isn't a part of your everyday routine in your everyday life, then we've got to work on a few things because You've been up there long enough. You know what it means to go to Tim's.
Yeah. Well, you know, Timmy's is my favorite. I love it. And, I'm slowly acculturating, right? You know, I'm apologizing a lot more. And so sorry if I interrupt you, sorry, you know, but yeah, well, you know, just a little bit, you know, I'll slowly become fully Canadized, I suppose. Right. So it'll be fine.
I'll know when you're fully ingrained in the culture, when I can bring you down here and take you to a hockey game and you'll be all in on it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay. So Sunday morning, I don't know. We don't have any real traditions, probably because I got a crazy 3.5-year-old and a crazy 1.5-year-old. And I don't know, they 3.5-year-old decides she wants to stay up till 10 o'clock at night because daddy, I'm not tired. And the 1.5-year-old's like, hey, 6 o'clock in the morning, awesome time to wake up. So it's like, for me, it's like, okay. So let's jump into it. So we had Gene Bingham, Donald L. Hallstrom, David A. Bednar, W. Christopher Waddell, W. Craig Zwick, and Henry B. Eyring as the speakers for Sunday morning. Let's get into President Bingham. So she referenced the natural disasters going on. And Stephen, one of the things that stood out to me was this was for as involved as the LDS Church was in a lot of these natural disasters and hurricanes, this is one of the few references we had to it. And I'm not sure about you, but I kind of thought that we would hear more about just everything that's going on. Did that stand out to you at all?
You mean specifically with the hurricane relief and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That is kind of interesting. I know that there was definitely a lot of very general, broad talk about the importance of service and lifting and helping others, especially in time of need. I don't know. I guess it's fitting that as the Relief Society president, you know, Sister Bingham would want to focus on this. It's very interesting. Maybe we'll see something more in the future about it. I do know that during the news report, right? The Mormon news report or whatever. They had a lot about talking about the hurricanes. They showed President Uchtdorf and President Eyring both going to different areas that had been affected. So I do know that, you know, the church has been sort of making public sort of the church's efforts about this and informing people about it. But it is interesting that they didn't quite, you know, bring it up as much during conference itself.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it was one of those, hey, we really don't want to be bragging too much about it, even though it was talked about. I don't know. It was something that stood out to me. And now that I think about it, maybe that is the reason why it is what it is. And we don't need to get into that. Elder Hallstrom. I'll be honest with all of you people. The next couple of speakers, I didn't get much out of. So, if you got anything, Stephen, chime in and help me out here. Elder Hallstrom to me looks like the type of guy who takes LDS church basketball way, way too seriously.
I think that's sort of a fair assessment to make. Yeah.
So served my mission in South Korea. One of the guys on my mission told me, he's like, I don't think you understand just how serious church ball is in Utah. And I was like, oh, please tell me how serious it is in Utah. He goes, I was at a church basketball game and a dad was just going ballistic. And I heard him after the game go up to the church ball coach and like pounding his fist in his hand, say, you need to know how this goes. It goes church ball, then AAU, then NCAA, then the pros. That's how it goes. And I was like,
oh my heavens.
So this is church ball in Utah. I'm not saying that would be Elder Hallstrom, but.
But you're saying it would be Elder Hallstrom. Yeah.
I'm just saying he looks like he takes it very seriously, like church balls.
Right.
So I don't know. I didn't have anything from Elder Hallstrom. I'm not sure if you had anything from him.
Not really. Just I thought it was remarkable that he got into theodicy. That was his big thing, right? Which theodicy is just a big fancy word for people trying to make sense theologically for basically when things go wrong, when the world goes wrong, when evil and suffering happens. How do we justify belief in God in the face of this? And Elder Hallstrom's question was sort of his rhetorical pointed question was, what happens when the miracles don't happen? You know, we talk about the importance of miracles and we believe in miracles, but what happens when they don't happen, when you don't get a miracle? How do you make sense of this? And so he had some thoughts on that I thought were nice. It's always sort of nice to keep that perspective that everything's not always just look through rose-colored glasses, right? That we have to recognize the reality and the complexity of existence and life. And so I thought Elder Hallstrom had some good thoughts there.
You know, and I'll admit, that's one of my pet peeves that sometimes when we have these general conference addresses, is we take extreme situations and talk about the extreme miraculous conclusions to them. And sometimes when that's all you're hearing, it kind of sets up the standard of like, well, that's supposed to be the norm instead of these are the extremes and the extremes are the extremes. So, hey, full credit where credit's due for him basically trying to address that difficult question. And I would say it's one of the deep theological and philosophical questions of why do bad things and where do we go with this? So,
oh, sure. Absolutely.
Credit where credit's due. Even though I would say if you got a basketball around him, be careful. Next up, Elder Bednar. And here's more of my looks like game. Look, we all know the easy joke about Elder Bednar that he looks like a Lego man with his hair, right? No. That joke's too easy, guys. Elder Bednar.
I've never heard that one before. That's new for me. That's good.
Oh, you've never heard that one yet?
No. That's new for me.
Okay. All right. So, hey, at least there's someone.
Yeah, on Twitter, my joke on Twitter was that Elder Bednar must be a Time Lord because he never ages. Like, I tweeted some pictures of him back when he was like a young missionary and then president of Rick's College and now here. And he looks exactly the same. So is he like the Keanu Reeves of Mormonism, right? Like he just never ages or changes at all.
I'm waiting for the day when someone's going to find like an 1850s picture and be like, is that him?
There it is. That's right.
Unless we want to start the rumor about like he's one of the three Nephites and that's why he never ages and et cetera.
Well, I do have a very credible tip from a source that I'm trying to confirm that Elder Bednar is in fact one of the three Nephites. He just doesn't really tell people because he's very modest about it.
Yeah. So if anyone could confirm that, because
I'm a critic. Yeah, I'll go to Reddit and see what Reddit has to say about it. But I think that's I trust my source on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of things. Elder Bednar looks like someone who measures his lawn with a ruler to make sure it's exactly within homeowners association guidelines.
Isn't that a thing up in Rexburg? Like, don't BYU Idaho students, they have to do that up there?
Well, they use rulers for a lot of things. Specifically, are your shorts too short? Is your hair too?
Oh, okay. Right. Of course.
Listen. Oh, you want to know a BYU Idaho story? Here's a great BYU Idaho story about how crazy they can be. There was a guy that came in here. His hair was a little bit long, right? I mean, it was the last day when the testing center was open, and goes up to the person in front of the testing center, and the person in front of the testing center says, "I'm sorry, your hair's too long." And he's like, "No, it's not." Like, and he like tucks it behind his ears. He's like, "It's not covering my ears. It's fine." "No, I'm sorry, man. It's too long." And he's like, "You got to be kidding me. I got a flight in 2 hours. I got to get out of here. I got to take this test so I can get out of here. What do you want? I'm sorry. I can't help you. You need to cut your hair." And he finally like just slams his hands on the table and goes, "Do you have any scissors?" The guy goes, "Yeah." He, no joke, took the scissors, snip, snip. "Is that good enough for you?" And then takes his test and goes in there. And
oh, my heavens. That's remarkable.
I was standing right behind him and I was like, "Huh, did that actually happen?" Let's see. Elder Bednar is the type of guy who not only has an extensively categorized food storage system, but diligently follows last in, first out standards in his rotation. He would be that guy, by the way.
Oh, he absolutely would. Yeah.
Well, this is about 10 years. We've had this for 10 years. We need to get this out now. So I'm not sure. Again, nothing really stood out to me with Elder Bednar. I didn't get much out of it. So
yeah. Same anything here, I guess. But it was just fine. Sort of Elder Bednar being Elder Bednar.
Yep. So let's go with Bishop Waddell. Bishop Waddell looks like the type of guy who doesn't really understand electronic dance music, but with a grimace, plays it in the car for his son, who would be happy.
Yeah.
And that's where I just was looking at him going, "Yeah, you would be the type of guy to be like, I don't understand this, but I'll play it for you. And it kind of hurts my ears."
That wasn't too bad. You know, that was maybe a 7 out of 10.
Listen, they're not all going to be winners, folks. Okay.
No, that's for the speakers, though. That's not for your jokes. Don't be mixing up the scales here now.
Well, I'm trying to go on your lit scale. So I've got some. next speaker, Elder Zwick. Elder Zwick looks like the type of guy who appreciates a good political debate as long as you agree with him. And as long as you're referencing, Rush Limbaugh as your
Breitbart, National Review and that sort of thing. Right. Yeah.
Elder Zwick looks like the type of guy who loves a mean grilled burger, but only if you use charcoal, not that gas malarkey. And this was the best one. Elder, in my personal opinion, since I wrote it, Elder Zwick looks like a Saturday Night Live cast member playing the role of Joe Biden in a skit.
You know, the Sisters in Zion Twitter handle, they tweeted out a picture of Elder Zwick next to Joe Biden. And it was shocking, the similarities between the two.
So I wasn't the only one.
No. Yeah, the Sisters in Zion also did it. So yeah, people are noticing it and it's remarkable and it's awesome. And I think it's great that we have Uncle Joe Biden in the church in the form of Elder Zwick.
Oh, yeah. So I remember liking his talk. I liked it. I don't remember much about it. But I just kept looking at it going, Zwick, why does that name look familiar? And I'm not sure if you guys would remember this. This is 5 years ago. But 5 years ago, when Mitt Romney was running for president, Elder Zwick got in some hot water because he was soliciting money to some people for the Mitt Romney campaign. Except he solicited the money for the Mitt Romney campaign from his LDS church email address. Uh-oh. And I went back and I found it. And I remember talking to someone who worked in the church office building and talking to them about that. And he's like, "Yeah." And he was actually someone in the IT field. And he's like, yeah. He goes, "You'd be surprised how many general authorities just are not very good about just technology and email and stuff like that. And how many issues that we."
So it's not just presidential candidates. It's also general authorities.
Oh, it's.
I guess that's a little bit of consolation, right?
Yeah. So that was Elder Zwick. President Eyring looks like the type of guy who, no matter how much his knees hurt, will always stoop down to be eye to eye with a child. President Eyring is the type of guy that gets a new tie for Christmas, his birthday, and Father's Day, and is genuinely happy every single time. I imagine him like taking out going, "This is exactly what I wanted. This is great." President Eyring is the type of guy who tears up every time he reads "Love You Forever" to his grandkids. But then again, don't we all tear up whenever we read that? President Eyring is the type of guy who diligently wants you to use the word end quote on your quotations or else he gets really confused. I imagine him being like, "Is that still part of your quote or is that you talking?" Or no, I need you to use end quote.
Does he use that commonly in his talks? Does he use end quote? I know President Monson loves to use end quote in his talk. Oh, yeah. So President Eyring is the same way.
I think he's the same way. Like there's a few that they just love it. I've tried to do it, but I can't because it's like, I think we're all good. Like, end quote. You say some stuff and then you're good.
Yeah.
President Irving looks like the type of guy who sees a handshake extended, throws out his arms, and wants to hug it out. I don't imagine him doing that many handshakes. I imagine him doing lots and lots of hugs. I think he's a hugger. So.
Oh, absolutely. You know something about, you know something about all these jokes, you know, these fun little quips about Elder Irving is, you know, they're kind of cute and we're kind of teasing him, but he is genuinely the most like kind and grandfatherly general authority I think that I've ever seen. Like I've heard Elder Ballard, I've personally in like state conferences heard Elder Ballard say, now think of me as your kindly old grandpa giving you some advice. But I don't think about him when I think about that. I think of President Irving, who genuinely has this like grandfatherly love whenever he speaks, right? And so I want to adopt him as my grandfather. That's what I'm saying, right? And who does?
I'm totally with you. So I've got my allegiance to allegiance. I graduated from BYU Idaho, so I'm always interested in what's going on there. And when his son was named president of BYU Idaho, I was so happy because of two things. Number one, the Irving family, I think nobody will contest the fact that they are really serious about their academics. And so having him in there, I was like, okay, this is good. And number two, by the time I graduated, I was pretty good friends with a good portion of the faculty, and they actually told me a lot of interesting stories about the administration. And one thing that they never said anything about was Henry J. Irving. They had nothing but good things to say about him. My wife was friends with Henry J. Irving's daughter and said that like, she's the daughter of an apostle. And I'm sure we all have those thoughts, but she had nothing but positive things to say. And I sit there and go, I think that's a reflection on him and probably his dad, but I'm with you. Like if he were to ever say something like, imagine this advice from your kindly old grandfather, I'd probably sit there and go, yeah. Cause I think of you like my kindly old grandfather.
Yeah. And you would look up with, you know, sort of the doughy puppy dog eyes, right? And just sort of take it all in. Absolutely.
All right. So let's move on to Sunday afternoon. M. Russell Ballard. So I'm going to need your help with this one because I saw like maybe a quarter of it. Sure. And then we had to eat dinner and do family pictures. Okay. M. Russell Ballard, Tad R. Callister, Joni L. Koch, Stanley G. Ellis. By the way, Elder Ellis looks like the type of guy that refers to his wild years as when I watched MASH every weekend and Johnny Carson every night. Or Elder Ellis looks like the type of guy who exclaims, oh, fish sticks, and then follows it up with, I'm so sorry for the language.
You know, I knew an Elder Ellis on my mission. He was my trainer's trainer, and he was the most intense missionary in the entire mission. Like he was like Law of Moses kind of missionary kind of thing. So whenever I see Elder Ellis or I think of Elder Ellis, I just think of Elder Ellis from my mission and his reputation for being the Law of Moses, right? So Elder Ellis, the general authority, right? He seemed like a pretty more chill kind of guy as he came across in his talk. But to this day, I'll always think of Elder Ellis from the mission as opposed to Elder Ellis from General Conference.
And then there was Adelson de Paula Perea. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Elder Perea looks like a business 101 professor. Ian S. Arden, who was from New Zealand. Jose L. Alonso and Neil L. Anderson. So the big news with this one was they found out at 12:15 p.m. Mountain Time. So literally as soon as the morning session ended that Elder Hales had passed away. Now, Stephen, there's something that stands out to me about. I received notification probably 45, it was less than an hour, 45 minutes after he passed away. All of a sudden, the news started breaking everywhere, right? Like Salt Lake Tribune and news and stuff like that. So think through this with me. If someone were to pass away and you received a credible tip that they had passed away, don't you think that if you waited maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes? So if we think about the timeline, enough time for you to get in contact with their family, let them have the news, let them have some time for themselves to break, and then you break the news. Don't you think it would happen relatively quickly?
You know, yeah, I think it would.
Okay, so I'm not crazy in thinking like nobody is sitting on credible rumors or credible tips for whatever ridiculous reason. And that was the thing that stood out to me. And I'll also say this. I was shocked that President Irving, who I don't think it's not a secret, and I don't think we're being disrespectful. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, and he is very quick to tear up.
Oh, let's be honest. President Irving cries at supermarket openings. Then again, I cry at Little League football games. So, you know, it's all fair.
That was pretty great.
That's a great joke.
And I love that you just popped in out of nowhere, Brian. That's what makes it so great. Just suddenly, oh, Brian's back.
Yes. Okay. He cries at a supermarket opening. But I'm actually shocked that he didn't tear up with the announcement of the passing of Elder Hales, because he was the one that was doing it. I mean, it's not a secret that everything that I've been told, and I think everything that goes on there and just the nature of what they do, I really do believe of them as a very strong and loving brotherhood. And for someone who's been in that quorum for 23 years to pass away for as much time as they're meeting together and talking together, I can't imagine that would be easy. And the fact that they had to go and sit through General Conference, having that sort of weight on them and sadness on them, it was very touching to see. So, all right. First up was M. Russell Ballard. This one really stood out to me. He started out with a Jane Manning James reference, which was amazing considering I just got done reading probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Max Mueller's great book, Race and the Making of the Mormon People. And we actually interviewed him on the show. That was the thing that stood out to me. But the big thing was he kind of got into it on, well, everything. I mean, it started out, there was a section where I was like, are you going to put everybody on blast? Stephen, what were some of the things that stood out to you about where he was going and some of the things that he had some pretty strong thoughts on?
Well, you know, Elder Ballard, he basically, I mean, took aim at everybody on all sides of the spectrum here when it came to problems that we're confronting with people on the left and on the right who are drawing away members, who are trying to set themselves up as some sort of an authority in lieu of or in place of the general authorities of leaders of the church. He called out fundamentalists on the right, some of these people who claim to have special revelations and special authority given to them that, you know, people need to follow them often to do other things. He called out people on the left who were drawing people away with politics and who were drawing them away with these sorts of things. He called out, I guess that wouldn't be quite political, but he called out, like, for example, MLMs and pyramid schemes and people that will sort of take Mormon credibility or credulity and sort of Mormon trusting, and they will exploit them for money. I think he explicitly said, we have a problem with sort of like get rich quick schemes in the church, right? Or in Mormon culture. He says, we have a problem with people who have these sort of supposed cures, quick cures for everything that we're buying into. And so he was just left and right. He was laying it out here saying, we have these problems. These are these alternative voices. I guess that's what Elder Oaks called them back in the day. But he's saying now we have all sorts of people claiming or vying for your attention, for you to follow them, for you to give them credibility. And they're either doing it through money or through claimed revelation or through politics or whatever. Don't listen to these people. They're not authorized. They will not lead you where you need to go. And I mean, it was like he took no prisoners, right? And I thought that was absolutely remarkable to get this fierce and in some cases this specific of a denunciation from an apostle.
There is a part of me, like I'm with you. Breath of fresh air, very refreshing to hear. It's a big, heavy sigh. There's a part of me that wonders if because that kind of language that he used was so forceful and because it's not used very often, that's the reason why he has to use it. So hear me out. They are usually very conservative with the language that they use because they don't want to, they just want to be very careful about how they say things. And so one of the problems, and I think we saw this perfectly play out with everything that happened in Charlottesville, one of the problems with using a little more tepid language like that is the people who should be getting the point don't get the point. And or even the people who might partially sympathize with them don't get the point. And so when he comes out like this and basically puts everybody on blast, it's refreshing, but it's like, it's refreshing because they don't ever do that. And part of me wonders if the problems that they're having with some of these groups are because they aren't more explicit saying this stuff has to stop. And especially when he was talking about, I call him the restorationist. So like the Denver snuffer movement and the remnant movement.
Yeah. The snufferite. Exactly.
Yeah. People like that. Like, that was pretty, pretty blunt. And we know that they've been on the LDS Church's radar for a while. And it makes me wonder, well, if you guys would go after them a little bit more and be a little more explicit with some of this stuff, you might not have to have these kinds of things happen. But that's just my perspective. Interestingly enough, he also had a pretty interesting quote on racism. Again, so this is the second reference that we've had to racism. Elder Crooks was the first one. I love the BYU General Conference corpus, and I was actually really disturbed because I was blocked out of there earlier today. And when I emailed the person to say, "Hey, can you unblock me? I don't know why I'm blocked." I got an out of office, and they ended up writing back and say, "Okay, you're all set." So, racism. The word racism has been used twice in LDS conference history, and both times were by Neil A. Maxwell in 1995. So that is specifically the word racism. However, the word racial has been used 36 times, including 7 times in the 1960s, which was the highest ever time that it was used. Now, when President Hinckley gave his talk back in 2006 about racism and racist attitudes, he actually used the word racial. And so that's why it might not have popped up with the original racism quote. But I always think that's interesting to take those individual words and say, okay, so what do we got with this? So those were my thoughts on that.
Just real quick, just to tally up so far for this conference, we've had denunciation of racism twice. We've had a recognition of the natural disasters 4 or 5 times. We've had a talk reaffirming the stance on marriage once. So just for all those who are listening in the pews, we've got a lot more positive here going on than what you might perceive as negative.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason why we want to do a bigger episode like this and an episode where we kind of got into it a little bit, just to be able to parse through some of the stuff that's out there, because obviously the Oaks talk got some national attention. But from what I was reading actually later this evening before we started recording on some of my news alerts, a lot more attention is being given to Elder Ballard and Elder Cook for actually coming out on racism. So that was the Ballard talk. The next talk was Tad Callister. To me, guys, Tad Callister looks like a BYU religious education professor. Like his face just screams it.
Like if they had an action figure of BYU religious education professor that you just like pull out of the box, it would be Elder Callister.
Steven, are you saying they don't have an action figure? I mean, I'm pretty sure if you went to the BYU store, you would find such an action figure.
Well, see, what I'm hoping is I'll become the next Indiana Jones or the Mormon Indiana Jones. And so I will become the next BYU religious education action figure. Right. And I'll have all the accessories. I'll have, you know, a whip and a hat and everything like that. It'll be great.
You're going to have the Joseph Spencer action figure, the deluxe model.
That's right.
The Tom Wayman deluxe model.
Tom Wayman. Yeah.
I love it. Let's do it.
So, Steven, I've got to imagine Tad Callister, another warm blanket of the Book of Mormon, just all over you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He was speaking my language. I got very, very excited, as people will see from my tweets during that time.
I understand you wrote his talk.
Well, that's what's so funny. I literally had a friend text me and he said, "Wait, did you write Callister's talk? LOL." Right. Like, it was uncanny. Right. And the whole time I was just kind of like you, Brent, I was fist pumping. I thought it was the greatest thing. So I was all for Elder Callister.
Okay, so I am going to say one thing, though, because I know that you know, everybody's taking this as Callister is laying down, look, the Book of Mormon is the real deal, yo, right? Like, it's and he gives a lot behind it, but most of it was based on how is it possible for this young, you know, mid-20s kid to make this thing? And then he gets into a lot of different points on how difficult it would be to create this kind of manuscript out of just nothing, right? And out of and trying to pull it together in the short amount of time that it was done. And I mean, and a lot of these points we've heard before, but I mean, he makes some pretty salient points. One of the things that I did notice, and Stephen, this is where you and I kind of bounce back and forth a little bit here. One of the things I did notice is that he used the term inspired way more than he used the term historical when it came to the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, right.
So what do you think the non-literalists are going to do with that? I mean, they're going to be like, yeah, see, he never said historical.
You know, that's a good question. I think between President Nelson emphasizing the significance of the doctrine and the fact that Elder Callister, as you said, there was more on the side of the inspiration, the doctrine, this is what makes it true and real and so forth. I think maybe you could find, if you want to say non-literalists, sort of clinging to that and sort of saying, look, there is still room for us here. After all, we can sort of make this work. On the other hand, though, I think it's going to be really, it would be really hard to maintain that too much, given the fact that Elder Callister, he laid down very specific historical arguments, right? He said, look, for example, for the longest time, they thought they didn't use cement in ancient America. Now they use cement in ancient America. We now know, right? Or they thought they didn't have steel swords. Now they have steel swords and so forth, right? He gave some specific examples.
Yeah, there was two or three in particular that were very specific and archaeologically derived.
Right. So I think, you know, And look, you know, people have asked me, because I've written on this before, and I like to say, I am not at all in the business of trying to push or scare or drive people out of the church who don't believe in a literal historical Book of Mormon. I believe very strongly in a historical Book of Mormon, but if you don't and you still want to be a member of the church, I'm totally cool to sit with you in the pews and to be your friend and your buddy. I just would think that people have to very seriously countenance or recognize what the church is teaching about this, what the discourse is these days with general authorities like Elder Callister and others, that this is a still a very significant thing, maintaining Book of Mormon historicity and authenticity, both doctrinally and historically. And so we got sort of both sides of the coin with President Nelson and then with Elder Callister. Individuals can work it out for themselves, how that works for them in their paradigm. But, you know, me personally, I thought it was remarkable. I thought it was great. I loved every minute of it. And I hope that we'll hear more sort of these discussions or these conversations so that we can see how we can make this work for everybody.
And I'll say this, one of the reasons why, Stephen, you're such a fascinating guy, because in some sections of the internet, they love you. And in some sections of the internet, they can't stand you. I think it's funny because it's just like rolls off your back. But the thing I like about it is I think that if you have someone who's willing to engage with you on things, that you can have that discussion. And I think that that's really what we need more of, instead of one side of the internet saying it must have, the Book of Mormon must have been this way, or the other side of the internet saying, no, it must have completely been all Joseph Smith. There's room in the middle, and there's a lot of room for us to talk and have conversations, and the work that you guys are doing with Book of Mormon Central, the work that other people are doing. We just had on Elizabeth Howlett from the University of Virginia, who was teaching an entire course on the Book of Mormon as literature.
Uh-huh, right.
Fascinating interview, right? There's so much good stuff there, and there's so much interesting stuff to get into. And that's where I just sit there and go, the politicization of all that stuff, no, I don't care about it. So, guys, that kind of rounds out what we got for General Conference. Anything else that stands out to you from General Conference this past October?
I guess just one thing that I'm interested in, and maybe you guys have the numbers on this, but by my count, just sort of informally listening, I think I heard heavenly parents, as in like, you know, your children, we are children of heavenly parents. I think I must have heard that maybe 4-5 times at the most between all the sessions, so about once per session. I thought it was remarkable because it seems like this language is increasingly being used. I wonder if you guys have any numbers on that, or maybe if you know what the average might be.
Ah, so it's funny you should ask. I actually do have the numbers on that. It's like we planned this out. Okay, so here's what we know. It was used sparsely until about the 1940s, and then it was used 6 times, right? And when I say sparsely, like maybe one reference here or there up until the 1940s. And then there was another drought, and then it was used 9 times in the 70s. And then here's where things get interesting. It was used 12 times in the 1990s, 15 times in the 2000s, and so far in the 2010s, it has been used 40 times. So yeah, I think it's going up. And Stephen, I'll be honest, I like it. I mean, it's a phrase that we should be using.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting.
But what about Heavenly Mother though? Like specifically Heavenly Mother.
Okay. So that's the one that doesn't have the same trajectory. It was used 5 total times in General Conference. That's it. It was used once in the 1920s, twice in the 70s, and twice in the 80s. And in case anyone asks, the phrase, so that one was Heavenly Mother. The phrase Mother in Heaven was used 27 times. So Heavenly Parents has been used a lot, especially recently. Heavenly Mother has not been used very often, but Mother in Heaven has been used at a semi-frequent basis. It was used 12 times between the 1880s and the 1920s. It was used 12 times from the 1970s until the 1990s. When it was actually used 6 times in the 90s, and that was President Hinckley's infamous 1991 talk where he said it was inappropriate for anyone in the church to pray to our mother in heaven. And so far in the 2010s, it's only been used twice. It was used once by Neil F. Marriott and once by Jeffrey R. Holland. So progress is Heavenly Mother has, or I'm sorry, Heavenly Parents have been used more, but explicitly using the phrase Heavenly Mother, Mother in Heaven, it's just not being used that often.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you.
So that rounds out the General Conference coverage. Stephen, we'd like to thank you for coming on. We'd like to thank you for giving us a credible perspective of General Conference this weekend and, you know, probably helping Brian and I to stay just a little bit young. If you want to track Stephen, you can find him on Twitter at Swiggity Swooty, SwiggitySmooty. And you can find his website at BookOfMormonCentral.org. You can also find it at PoloniAlmoniMormon.com. Did I get that right?
You got it right. Perfect. It's probably the most pretentiously sounding blog name that you hear, but you got it right. So perfect.
Thank you so much for coming on, Stephen. We really appreciate it.
Well, hey, thanks. Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun. Thanks, guys.
And we'll be back in a minute.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. 60 years ago this week, on October 1st, 1957, General Conference was canceled due to a flu epidemic. Brian, canceled.
Yeah, you know, and I got to be honest with you, Brant, the flu like cruised through my household this week, like death going, passing over us. Every one of my kids got it, and I ended up with it towards the end of the week. I kind of don't blame them. I kind of wanted to cancel General Conference this, you know, to be honest with you.
Well, you know, the worst part is when you've got the flu with kids, like no one gets an off day. So even though you might feel utterly horrible, no, you still got to be dad.
And that's our show. We'd like to thank Stephen Smoot for joining us. Remember, you can find his blog at PlonyAlmoniMormon.com.
We'd like to thank Scott Holmes for the music. Brian Whitney edited today's show. We'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. If you like what we're doing, please go ahead and tell your friends about us.
And if you really want to help us out, give us a review on iTunes. It only takes a few minutes and it makes all the difference.
Also, if you want to reach us directly, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. We'll be back next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with just a sprinkling of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.